Hi, Carol Newman. Is anybody else on?
Stephanie Hendrickson.
Hey, Stephanie. Welcome.
Hey.
Hey. Sounds like in or out? No. Carol Newman's on. Stephanie Hendrickson's on. Who else joined?
Tom Gower just joined.
Hey, Tom. Welcome. I don't know that Dwight's on yet.
Okay. So are you guys going to Old Dominion?
We are.
Trailer. Good luck.
Thank you. Trailer's close to packed. And Tom's on his way to Fort House.
Oh, wow.
Literally. I'm in the car. I don't know how this is going to work.
Is that this weekend?
This coming weekend, yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, good luck.
Thanks.
Are you doing the 100 FEI?
Yep.
Oh, great.
I'm going to give it a shot.
Yeah.
Best of luck. Stag, could you try calling Dwight? On the theory that he might have not picked up his email. Yeah. Okay.
Hello.
Okay.
Hey, Carol Newman's on. Who joined?
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Who joined?
John and Carol Marsh.
Hey, welcome, John. How are you doing, Carol?
Hi. Good, thank you.
Our clinician hasn't joined yet.
Okay. So you guys been getting some writing in?
A bit. At least some of us are looking forward to the Old Dominion, and Tom Gower, who's also on the phone with us, is on his way to Fort Howes in Montana. So.
Oh, I saw that email that you were able to stop, huh, Tom?
I think he's driving.
I'm driving, yeah.
Oh, I see. Oh, good.
Cheryl and Stag, did you all see the message from Marguerite that they're committed to all the seminars they can do this year?
Yeah, I am. Let's just say I got to talk to Jeff Pauly about this.
Oh, yeah?
I'm sorry. Hang on. Do I have what? Dwight's none. Cars down below in the house, at the farm building, yeah. Oh, well. We'll do two things. One is we'll send Stag down to try to track down a phone number for Dwight.
Okay.
It turns out that we left the car down at the farm building, and I think his PC is in the car, and it's like, oh, yeah. Better do something about that under any circumstances, and then...
What horses are you all taking to OD?
Super's doing the 100.
Uh-huh.
And then Beverly Brock is riding Winston in the 55.
Oh, okay.
And then the following weekend up at, I think they call it the Derby Dash or the Kentucky Stampede.
I love those trails.
Anyhow, we'll take a couple of guys to the 55 there.
Yeah, it's pretty technical. That's what I like about it. Pretty technical.
That's good.
Yeah. Oh, I love technical. A lot of up and down and rocks, so you have to maneuver. So I really like it.
Yeah, good. And I think Jake and Orion will probably have a good time there.
How's Orion doing?
Orion seems to be doing fine.
Good.
We've had him out for the last couple of weekends, and he seems to think he's doing 100%. And seems to be doing very nicely.
Well, good.
Yesterday we had him out for 3 hours.
Oh, that should be good. So you're doing the 55 at Derby Dash?
Yeah.
On Friday or Saturday?
Saturday.
Okay. I may drive over and help crew or something.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2 hours from my house. It's
really?
Oh, yeah, it's so close. I love doing that ride. I can't ride for a while, but... that's one of my favorite rides.
Right. So we've never been there. We're looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Tom, have you been there?
No, I haven't.
Carol and John, have you been there?
No, we haven't.
Carol's horse has been there.
Yeah, my. I think he went with Pete Reese.
Whatever.
At some point.
Could be.
Yeah. Yeah, that trail just has a good mix of some flat roads, you know, just dirt roads as well as the technical stuff. So if you've got a good technical horse, I mean, you can really, really eat that up. If you've got somebody who can do hills and scoot over the rocks, that trail is just perfect for that.
Yeah, I'm not entirely convinced any horse. I don't think I can ride horses over rocks particularly well.
Wow.
Hello there.
Hey, who's this?
This is Dwight.
Hey, Dwight, welcome.
Thank you very much.
This is Cheryl.
Hey, Cheryl.
And we've got Stephanie Hendrickson, Tom Gower, and John and Carol Marsh on the line. And Stag has just left to go down and try to track down your phone number.
Okay. Well, he doesn't have to do that because
yep.
I'm sitting here right now. And how do we need to start? Being my first one, I don't know the procedure.
There is no what I would call fixed format or fixed format. Hang on, let me just holler out to Stag. It's online, Stag. Anyhow, and at the same time, I think we frequently start off with, you know, you give like a 3 to 5 minute, you know, on the topic, whatever thoughts you might want to have, and then we can plow into the questions and let things sort of evolve.
Okay.
The topic and is evaluating your training program and undertraining, overtraining. How do you tell?
And that is a real challenge. Let me just first say that I think that the initial probably the initial part of the discussion should be on goal setting. The reason I say that is that I think that you're fairly, you and I have talked enough that you know that my feeling is that in America we endurance ride, in the rest of the world they endurance race, and yet we want to compete with the world with the notion that we're endurance riders and that to finish is to win. All other places in the world to come across the line first is to win, and they all make efforts at judging best condition, and everybody knows that it's the booby prize. And so around the world, that's the way it is. And in the Middle East, that's the way it is. And in South Africa, that's the way it is. In Europe, that's the way it is. And so those are the places that I have been specifically where FEI is the predominant set of rules that are followed. And people seek to win. Now, I'm not saying that when we go to a world competition that we're not interested in a bronze medal. But I'm just telling you that that to finish is to win will not garner very many medals. And so if we're going to look at competition on the international scene, and if this discussion is to be geared toward that, then we'll have one series of discussions. If we are talking about how to best condition our horses to win or to compete on the continent, then that's a different situation. And so
we probably have let's just say the gamut on the call.
Yeah, and that's okay. I'm comfortable about either one, but I think that those who have not ridden internationally that may be on the call should appreciate that our philosophy is different than many others, and that's not to say that all of Europe and all of the UAE and all of South Africa compete only to come across the line first, because that's not true. But the people that are in the World Equestrian Games are going to win the gold medal, and so that's a little different approach than to being able to compete in and complete the Tevis or complete Vermont or complete the Old Dominion. Yeah. Those goals are lofty, and those of us that have had the pleasure of either judging or competing in those recognize just how tough that is and what a goal that is. But it's different than trying to get across the line first.
Right.
So, at any rate, now then, I will begin to address the questions that you sent on the email. And then I think that everybody should feel comfortable to stop me at any time and ask questions. I'm quite comfortable about that. One of the things that we're going to get to, and I unfortunately have a book, and it has escaped me. So somebody that has the ability to be online here that can do a search on Amazon. If you put in something like swimming, training, and lactic acid, or lactate, you will find the name of probably two or three, maybe four books, but there's one particular one, and I may recognize the name if somebody's able to recite it for me. But at any rate, that will be useful later on.
Dwight?
Yes.
Yeah. I'll see if I can find that. I think you're making an absolutely great point, which you have to start with goals. Let me add, just to complicate things further, because you talked about the difference between, you know, completing and getting your Tevis buckle and Old Dominion. But I think there's another dimension that I'd be interested in your comments on as we go through, and that is peaking for that one world event versus having a horse that does well over 10 or 20 years and whether those are mutually exclusive or not. You may still want to compete at a high level in the U.S., but there's also...
That's a really, really good point, because that's something that there are people that are going to want to go to the WEG example. May not be only the WEG, but going to want to go to the WEG in Lexington, and are going to want to set their horse up for that. And there are some things that we do differently and should be doing differently to prepare a horse for an event like that. And whenever you think it's appropriate, I'm happy to talk about that. Should I deal with questions that were presented first?
Yeah. If you don't mind, let's sort of go through the questions as they were presented, and we'll try to make sure we get to all of them. And let me, the first one, you know, how do you tell when a horse is in risk of being overtrained or has been overtrained? And I'm going to holler at Stag in the meantime. Hang on.
Okay. Has been overtrained is probably an easier thing to address than is overtrained. And has overtrained is the horse that is probably a little off of his feed, and he's just as fit as a fiddle, may even be a little bit on the thin side, and maybe doesn't feel just quite right to you. Those are the ways, and listen, there are no scientific ways that we have available to us now that will tell us that, and here's the reason. If we jump down to item number six, question number six, about what did I find out in the UAE, what I found out in the UAE was that we did blood work on horses weekly for 2 or 3 years, and we were not able to predict from their blood when they were going to have a catastrophic injury. And I don't mean catastrophic as in, you know, break their neck or break a leg. I meant when they were going to have a breakdown as in a tendon, a suspensory, a joint, that sort of thing. We were not able to predict that with blood work. So the systems of blood work that are available to us at the moment are not able to predict that. So how do you know that the horse has been overtrained? Well, you as riders, and I like not to rely on you as riders because you have so many biases. But having said that, you as riders are the very best tool that a veterinarian has to be able to identify a horse not doing right. Now, many, many times you will go to your veterinarian and say, this horse doesn't feel right to me, and the veterinarian will trot the horse out and say, well, I can't see anything, and he is being honest. He cannot see anything. You can feel it far, far sooner than even the trained eye can see it. And so I rely heavily on writers to tell me what's going on. Now, in that regard, you have to become a little bit better educated, maybe not better. You know, you guys may be just perfectly educated. But you have to be educated a little bit in dressage techniques to be able to identify which leg it is that may be off so that you can direct the veterinarian. And the reason that that's important is that when you first begin to feel that the horse is off, that's when it is repairable. By the time most riders call a veterinarian, the horse is already broken. And that's an unfortunate thing, and then that's going to require a longer period of time. Doesn't mean it can't heal, just means it's likely to require a longer period of time or more active involvement on the part of the veterinarian to heal it. Now, you guys with physical therapy things that you do, ice, controlled exercise, massage, chiropractic, acupuncture, that sort of thing, you all have quite a bit of impact on the healing the horse, because that kind of regular attention is far more beneficial than a single shot of Adequan that I give the horse, or a single shot of Legend that I give the horse. So it's real important, the physical therapy things that you do, in terms of being able to rehab them. But let me get back to the question and finalize my answer about how do you tell when the horse is at risk or in risk of being overtrained. That's probably more a function of your program than it is the horse. And we're going to address some issues that have to do with is it a numbers game or is it a matter of being able to choose the right athlete. We'll talk about that a little later when we get to that question. But at the current state of affairs, I don't have a way of telling you when your horse is at risk of being overtrained. But when you have a goal in mind, and it's a lofty goal, and you're pressed for time, or you have a delay, you know, mother-in-law breaks her neck and you have to go take time out of training to go take care of her, or, you know, any number of different things that interrupt your training program, if you go back and train faster and or harder than what your original plan was, then your horse may be at risk of being overtrained in the short run. In the long run, the horse will only be overtrained if it is overridden, and you guys probably know that better than I do. So,
now say that again. Your horse will only be able to be trained or overtrained?
Overtrained.
If it is overridden, okay.
Yeah, if he's overridden. And when I say overridden, I don't mean on a single event. I mean overridden as in trained too hard without an appropriate amount of rest. And when we get to the question that Stag asked about how do we set up a horse for a big event, then we're going to talk about adequate rest. And adequate rest is incredibly important. And it's something that we're all afraid of giving because we're worried that they're going to lose too much condition while they're resting. But when we talk about how you train a horse, I mean, what you have to do in order to get a horse to train up to a higher level, we will discuss the issue of rest and why it's so important. So, sorry that I didn't have a better answer for you on the risk of being overtrained or being overtrained, but that's something that you guys as riders will have to be able to that's your gut feeling more than it is my evaluation.
Dwight?
Yes.
You talked about, you know, using dressage to sort of tell you. I'm trying to sort of translate that into, so what would it show up? I mean, one, you may, obviously, if you feel the unevenness, but is it going to even be more subtle, like slight, you know, the horse is showing resistance to one direction versus the other?
Correct.
Would you expect
those are,
to really...
Those are other indications that he is having. And there's two sides to this coin. One is overtrained, but overtrained means that we've overworked a particular structure, perhaps, and that then is where the pain is coming from. The pain is coming before the horse actually breaks, and his resistance or his change in motion, the change in his feel under you is the clue that you have that something's not right. When I talked about dressage training, I'm not suggesting that you all stop what you're doing and go take up through third-level dressage. But what they teach you in dressage is to feel each individual limb as it moves. And I can't do this, but Anita if can ride a horse, and she can tell me left hind, right front, left front, as they move, and she knows exactly which one. She feels that. And so that is the that would be your goal, not necessarily immediate goal, but that would be the goal, is that you would get to where you knew your horse well enough and you felt your horse well enough that you could say to me, he doesn't feel right on his right front. Now, I can't tell you how many people tell me, well, he's off in his right front, when in fact he's limping on his left front, or he's limping on his right hind rather than his right front. And so that's a matter of experience and time, and I'm not suggesting that you guys want to quit endurance riding to learn how to do dressage or to learn how to do lameness evaluation, but what I am saying is that when you feel that the horse is not right, then you need to that's when you need to kind of turn on your thinking cap and say, now just exactly where do I think this horse feels different? And if it is, you know, turning to the right, now many times we'll see that a horse will turn very well to the left and does not want to turn to the right. Why? Well, that can be because he's sore in a suspensory on the right front, or I mean a left front, and he doesn't want to push off of the left front as he turns to the right. Or it could be that he is sore in a right hock, and he doesn't want to bring that leg up underneath him as he turns to the right. And on occasion, it can be the left hock, because as he's turning, he's actually pushing hardest, taking the longest stride with the left hind as he's turning to the right, and so it may be painful for him to take a long stretch stride with that, to push on it for a longer time. So that's what I'm saying, is that those are just the kinds of things that should be a goal for you when you start feeling that your horse is off, rather than jump off of him and get on the phone to the vet. Try and spend a little time with him to be able to identify as best you can what the symptoms are. You don't have to decide that it's the left hind or the right hind, but be sure that you get a good set of symptoms down so that when you do talk to someone, that you can tell them, this is what he's doing. That kind of thing helps me a lot, an awful lot, in determining where a lameness is. Shall we move on to another question?
Can I ask one quick question?
Please.
Are there other consequences of overtraining other than orthopedic kind of problems? Other physiologic problems that might evolve?
Metabolic. Horses that are overtrained tend to get appetite suppression, and therefore don't want to or have difficulty maintaining weight. Now that is, I'm not sure that there are others. That's the major one that I observed when I was in the UAE, is that when those horses were overtrained, the trainers said, oh, well, that's good. They're trimmed all their body fat off, so they don't carry any extra weight. Problem with that is that they also did not have any reserves.
Right.
So that when they hit the wall, there was no recovering during that event from hitting the wall.
Okay.
And I use that hitting the wall. That's a term, you know, that we all are fairly familiar with, and I think all endurance riders that have done very very serious riding have felt a horse do that. And you work them through it.
And you're actually, I was toying with bringing this up, and since you brought it up, I'm going to pursue it a little bit, Dwight. How the horses that are running internationally, it seemed to me to be, let's just say, leaner than a lot of the other horses that I'm seeing, that I've seen historically or something like that. And you're familiar with what stags Druban looked like. And
yes.
I contrast a Druban type, who I mentally think of as a boiler, versus some of the more leaner types that are out there today. Can lean types adapt across a bunch of different terrains and things like that in your current experience, or is there still a niche, if you will, for other body types?
Yes, certainly the other body types are going to be, well, let's not talk about the generic other body types. The more compact and more muscular horses are going to do better in mountain rides. And because they just simply have more reserve to power up those hills. Having said that, we noticed that in the sand, which is the only way that we have had in the Middle East to stress a horse, either speed or sand, that the thinner horses managed to go through the sand pretty well. And that the heavier horses, the complication was in that venue was that if we had, we almost always had, at least in the UAE, we always had a fair bit of humidity and was generally warm at some point during the day, maybe not all of the race, but some point during the day. And so the combination of heat and humidity, I mean, we all know that that's devastating. And the thinner body type horses, of course, do better in that. The heavier, thicker body type horses, of course, those horses would do better in colder environments and with hillier environments.
Dwight, also I wonder in the typical flat fast race, your checkpoints are going to come much sooner. Therefore, you have the chance to replenish nourishment more frequently than you would on, I mean, take Tevis as the extreme, where, you know, it may be 30-some miles with, you know, huge elevation changes before you get to the next checkpoint. Am I right in saying that's also a big factor in favoring the thin versus in some of our rides where you need a lot more reserves?
Right, right. And the Tevis being you're right, that is maybe the best example of you have a lot of work to do and over a long distance before you can stop and replenish. And, you know, we accept the fact that if they'll drink, we'll let them drink any time we find water. And so my experience is most horses don't drink until about 30 miles, even if you had four vet stops before then. They're still not going to drink until about 40 miles unless it's exceptionally hot. Now, I don't know if that's different at the Tevis. You know, I've never worked the Tevis, and so I don't know if horses start drinking sooner there than they do in other races, but all up and down the races that I have done up and down the East Coast and in Mid-America, those were all the same. Horses just didn't drink early on. And so they tend to need to go about that distance, 20 to 30 miles, before they get thirsty, unless they're going really, really fast, and then they'll get, if they're really sweating hard, then they'll want to a little bit sooner. But you know, we saw horses in the Middle East that would sweat hard on the first loop and still would not come in and drink, even if it was, 65, 70 degrees at the end of that first loop. They still wouldn't drink, even if they sweated a lot. So it typically takes until the second loop in the Middle East before we see them start to drink much. Now, that was not what we were talking about. We were talking about the body types. And so, yes, I think there is a niche for the thicker body types. I will suggest to you that the current status of championship rides is that they're going to be faster and flatter. Now, I don't know how flat Kentucky is going to be, but I can promise you it's going to be flatter than Tevis or the Old Dominion or Vermont. And so it will be a fairly fast race because the pace is going to be pretty quick. And if there are enough good horses come to that thing, and we have to believe there will be, that there will be some people that will push that pace pretty quickly and quicker than what might seem sensible. But the reason is that those people are going to try to win the gold. They're not coming to complete. So, shall we move to another question?
Yeah, Dwight, before we do that, tell me those key words. I've forgotten one of the three to do that search for the book. Swimming, lactate.
Swimming and lactate, maybe swimming training and lactic acid or lactate.
Okay, and this was, but horses, no.
No, humans. It's humans.
Oh, and humans.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I was putting horses in as a keyword.
Yeah, no, if you put horses in it, you'll draw a blank.
Okay.
Because nobody has swum horses and measured lactates that I'm aware of.
Okay, I may have found it already then. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, whenever you do, just shout that name to me and I'll recognize it. It's a paperback book, and I can't remember when it was published. But at any rate, the reason that I brought that up, and I guess...
All three?
Pardon?
There's a book called Training Lactate Pulse Rate.
No, that's not it. That one may be useful. I have not read that one. At any rate, so,
next question. Given an American endurance horse that has been trained for diverse types of endurance competition, including rugged mountain rides, and has not been trained explicitly for flatter, faster rides, how would you modify that horse's training for competitions such as Kentucky Pre-Weg?
Well, and until I have seen the proposed Weg Trail, I can't tell you specifically, but generalities, let me speak to you in terms of generalities about how you do this. Is that you don't train on rugged trails. You train on trails like at the Biltmore or the local racetrack or some of the Southern California desert tracks or some of the Southern New Mexico desert tracks or some of the Texas tracks that let's see, some of the Georgia tracks. There were a few, and the Florida tracks. The flatter tracks that, and South Carolina for that reason.
Yeah, let's say South Carolina should offer, yeah.
Yeah, but what you want to do is that you need a track that you can go fast and long. In order to do this, and doesn't mean you start out fast and long. Of course you don't. You build up to fast and long, and your attempt is to train these horses at a canter more than at the trot. Now, having said that, if you're going to trot the course, then you really do need to train at the trot. If you intend to canter the course, then you have to train at the canter. Horses in Dubai and in Abu Dhabi train exclusively at the canter. And they do all of their training at the canter because that is all they intend to do during the race. The only time that they will trot is if they run into some deep sand, where they absolutely have to. And even then, there will be people that will canter the sand. So what we find is that at a given speed, horses' heart rates will be lower at the canter than they will be at the trot.
Right.
The reason that we have all thought that it was safer or better to trot is because there are 2 feet on the ground at one time, and henceforth a bit safer for the animal. And that is true. However, it is not less stressful on the animal because, and you can tell that if you monitor your heart rate, you'll find that at 12 miles an hour, a horse that's trotting 12 miles an hour will have a higher heart rate than a horse that's cantering at 12 miles an hour, or 10 or 9. And so you sort of have to look at the track you're going to run and decide whether or not you can canter and how much you can canter as opposed to how much you need to trot. And then you need to train for that. People that I know that are training for international competition that are expecting to go to places like Argentina the Pan Ams, Uruguay this last April, those are all going to be cantering races. And so you need to train. Those people train at racetracks, and it is boring. But the reason that you do that is that you select a track where you're not likely to step on a stone. You're not likely to injure a horse by taking a bad step on a stone. And if you train them, interval training is one good way to work up to the ability to be able to train long and hard at speed. And interval training is a good, as I say, it's a good building block, a good stepping stone to get to that level. Then you get on the local racetrack or on the Biltmore trails or on DJ's trails or Valerie's trails or on and on and on and on. And you just need to put in the time, and you have to work up from a slow speed and intermittent cantering to faster and longer cantering. And you use the heart rate, your heart rate monitor, to evaluate that and to judge that. And you take the horse up to what you feel like is your comfortable heart rate. And it's whenever you have taken him long enough at a steady heart rate, when his heart rate begins to climb is when he's beginning to get tired. That's not rocket science. Everybody knows that. But the other way that you can do it, if you're interval training particularly, is that you can train them hard enough that when they begin to feel like they're fading, when they begin to feel like they're losing the power, then that's when you have to take them just a little bit farther. And then you jump off real quick and you pull out your lactate monitor that is about the size of a cigarette package, and you whip out a little vial full of test strips and a small needle, and you take a hub full of blood from the vein and put it on the test strip and plug it into the machine. And if you don't do it just about as quickly as I have just described it, it will not be useful to you. Because horses are so incredibly good that they recover so quickly that if you're going to use lactate as a method, lactate evaluation as a method of evaluating your training, as described in this book that we're going to find in a minute, then that is a really good way to find out that you've pushed your horse hard enough to increase his fitness.
Okay.
Now, if we find that book name, and anybody that's interested in it, in reading this thing, it would be really, really good, because the principles are the same thing that we do in endurance.
Okay.
Training for swimming are exactly the same thing as the principles that we use. The only difference is that in the pool, you can do muscular damage, but it's hard to do a lot of ligament or joint damage in the pool. We still have, because we're riding, we still have the potential to do ligament and joint damage.
And Dwight, I've got a book here called Lactate Threshold Training by Peter Johnson and Peter Jansen. Is that it? Or
that may very well be it. It sounds like, I'm pretty sure that is it.
Yeah, it sounds from the description I've got here, it sounds like it.
Anyway,
email that.
Everybody know that, and then I will find out. I'll find this book. I'm sure it's packed somewhere, and I just can't locate it right at the moment. But I'll find it in the next few weeks, and be sure that you guys have the reference if that's not it. And I'm pretty sure that is the right one. Anyway, the lactate training is the ultimate in terms of endurance training for swimmers, and I have done it on endurance horses in the Middle East, and it did work.
But not by swimming them, by running them on a track.
Yeah, not by swimming them. We did swim horses in the Middle East, and we did swim them to the point of near exhaustion, and we did swim them to the point that we did have some increased lactate. But the problem is that most people don't have pools, and most people don't have enough courage to swim them 50 or 60 laps continuously but without a rest, and that's what it takes in order to drive the lactate up in a horse.
And what is your definition of fast and long?
Well, I guess the first thing I would ask you is, what is your goal?
Okay. So say it's a top 10 and a 50.
Okay, a top 10 and a 50 in the USA?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then you don't have to be real fast. You can probably
right.
top 10 a 50 in the USA at, say, 16 kilometers per hour. Up to about 20 kilometers per hour. And I don't have my calculator here, Stag. You may have to convert that to miles.
Well, 16 would be 10 miles an hour.
Right? Yeah, about 10.
Yeah. And so what you need to do is you need to be able to do about a 25-mile training loop. Now, this is the final training. What I'm talking about, the final training that you would do before you went to the race. You'd need to be able, and this would be a week away from a competition for a really good fit horse, and maybe 10 days to 14 days away from a competition for a less than perfect fit horse. But you would need to be able to do that 10 miles an hour, and you'd need to go 25 miles.
Okay.
It go half the distance of your race, but at race speed.
Okay, that makes sense.
What are the top horses in the UAE doing as far as speed and duration?
Well, we would train at full speed for if we were doing almost all the rides that we do over there are 120 kilometers, 75 miles. And we would do 30 miles of training at full race speed, anywhere from about 10 days to a week before.
Huh.
Are there breaks in that 30 miles, or you just do 30 miles and you run it?
Yeah, no. We would stop for water. We'd probably do 15 miles without a stop. First 15 miles would be without a stop. Then we would stop for water. Do 10 miles, stop one more time for water, and then do the last 5 miles. We might even increase the speed up to about 30 kilometers per hour. Which,
right.
What does that wind up being? 20 miles an hour? Not quite.
Yeah.
And so, we would always finish. Now, having said that, when we trained in the UAE, a veterinarian would oftentimes be driving in a car along with the horses, oftentimes, not always, because there were so many horses in training and so many different trainers that there weren't enough veterinarians to go with everyone each and every day, and if they did that, then they didn't have time to do work on any lame horses. But on the big training rides, when we were really getting ready and setting the horses up and running at these speeds, then that day I would be with them, or one of the other veterinarians would actually go out on the training track. And of course, as you may know, there we can drive beside the horse every place they go. And so there would be a veterinarian out there. And if a horse faltered, if a horse ran out of gas, or if a horse wasn't fit enough, and we pull them. And even if I was, you know, we were doing the first loop, the first 15 miles before we stopped, then we would, if I saw a horse that I wasn't comfortable with, I had the ability to be able to stop it at any time. But typically what we would do is we would go at the first 15 miles because the horses would be fresh and they'd be pretty chargy, and we'd go 15 miles before we stopped for water. We'd stop for water. We'd check pulses on all the horses. We would typically pulse them down, let them pulse down to 64, and then as soon as they hit 64, we'd jump on them again and go and do another 10 miles. And sometimes they would drink in the first at that first stop, and sometimes they wouldn't. But they'd always drink at the second stop, unless there was something wrong with them. And then we at the second stop we didn't feed them. We'd pulse them down, and we'd probably let the riders take a pee and drink a little water themselves, and rest maybe 5 or 10 minutes after they pulse down, and then we'd gather up and go, with the last 5 miles being pretty brisk.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
It is fun. It is fun. It was a lot of fun. And what we found is that the majority of horses could do that. Now, we also found that there were relatively few horses that could complete 75 miles at, say, above 22 kilometers an hour. When we got above 22, there were a lot of horses that could complete at around 20. We got up to 22, they started fading fast, and when we got over 22, then it was strictly the elite athletes that would be able to do that. Now, it's really interesting because even the elite athletes might have a day when they couldn't do that. They couldn't do that
and
day.
It was 22 clicks an hour, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was for what length race, 75?
75.
Okay, so that's... I'll translate that into U.S. units shortly.
Yeah.
About 14 miles an hour.
Yeah, so for a 75-mile race, that's what we're looking at, a sub-6-hour. Five and a half hours.
That was typical. Not when I first went there, but by the time I left, 5.5-hour finishes on a 75-mile race were fairly typical.
Right.
Fairly typical. Now, there would be days when the environmental conditions, particularly the heat and or humidity, when it didn't happen. But what happened on those days is that the people that were training to try to be able to do a 5.5-hour 75 would wind up finishing or winning, and the elite athletes would go out. Because they would still try to go at that speed, and they would somewhere along the line they would either lame out or would fail to recover at one of the vet stops, and then they would be eliminated. And this was all before the latest FEI rules that give you a stigma about having too many metabolic pulls, the time I was talking about, they didn't care how many metabolic pulls because they just give them the time off and bring them back again and try it again.
If that was the last workout 10 days to 2 weeks before a race that length, what's the 6 months working up to that look like?
Well, it's just gradually increasing intensity, and you have three options to increase the intensity. Increase in speed, increase in climb or elevation change, or increase in weight carried. Now, we did a bit of the increased weight, and we found that we damaged too many horses. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. Because the increase in weight was more profound than the increase in speed.
When you say increase in weight, are you talking like 5 pounds or more than...
Yeah, no, we're talking about more than that. We're talking about 15 or 20 pounds.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, that's what they're proposing for the WEG horses in the United States, is that to increase the weight 40 to 50 pounds.
Yep, and if you go slowly, that's good.
Yeah.
If you don't go too fast, that's fine. But if you go fast and so probably the ideal thing is to do a slow ride with increased weight and then a medium speed ride with increased terrain, if that's an option, and on flat ground, you need to go faster.
Okay.
Why do you need to go faster on flat ground? Because it's safe enough to be able to do that, and you have to train those muscles to be able to go fast.
What are you talking about as a baseline weight carried?
Well, for FEI competition, you got to carry
165.
75 kilograms.
Yeah. So is that what you're talking about, increasing over that weight?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you've got to be able to carry 75.
Right.
And so if you're a lightweight rider or a featherweight rider, then you've got to carry extra weight. And that extra weight flapping on the horse's back, and I'm exaggerating a bit there, but that extra dead weight being carried by the horse is a lot tougher than the same live weight with a good rider. With a mediocre rider, it's no worse than the mediocre rider. Now, I would assume that we don't have many mediocre riders in America that are going to make that level. I will promise you there will be a lot of mediocre riders from other countries that make that come to the WEG.
Although that's probably even changing in some of the countries, right?
Well, it is. And, you know, Australia is going to bring good riders, and France is going to bring good riders, and Spain is going to bring good riders. But Namibia probably will not have the very best riders, and Malaysia may or may not have the best riders. Typically, the royal family are, with the exception of Dubai or the UAE, typically the royal family are not the best riders. And they like to be a part of it because of all the notoriety. But typically the royal family members that choose to ride, as I say, with some notable exceptions in the Middle East, in UAE, those people are doing it because they're pressured to by their family or their political system. And riding is not their passion, and so therefore they're typically not as accomplished. But they will have some of the best horses because they also have money, and they'll go out and hunt the best horses that they can buy.
Should we continue on the questions here?
Where are we?
We're on question number 3 at this stage.
Okay, we're moving right along.
Lots of other questions in the meantime. There are many interesting things. How many conditioning rides a week are appropriate in preparing a horse for a major competition? We sort of skirted around that one, but not necessarily attacked head on.
And that depends a lot on where the horse is in his conditioning and where what kind of terrain you have to condition on, and how far away from the event. As you get closer and closer to the event, your work up to about 2 weeks out, your work should be increasingly intense. In other words, each week it should get harder, and you should be taking more rest, because the harder the horse works, you recognize that the only way to increase his fitness is to break him down. You've got to break down muscle in order to make more and better and fitter muscle build back. So every time, your goal should be to injure your horse each and every time you ride him, and then to let him heal. When you injure him, it's micro injury. And if you read that book, they talk about that with muscle, is that you have to, the reason that you measure lactate is that lactic acid is a byproduct of muscle breakdown. And when you break down muscle, then you have stressed the body to the point that the body says, I need more muscle, and or stronger muscle or harder muscle or whatever the kind of muscle that, that you want depending upon what you're doing. So you break down the muscle a little bit, you release a little bit of lactic acid into the blood. That tells you that you did enough work, and then you give the body a chance to recover through rest. So how many conditioning rides a week? More early on, fewer later on, but the ones later on are harder. Harder meaning faster on flatter ground, faster on or more elevation change at a given speed, which people that live in and or near the mountains and can train in the mountains know how to do that. You know, you go up a little bit more grade at the same speed, or you go up the same grade at a little bit faster speed, depending upon the safety of the footing for the horse. And then if you're going to use weight to do that, then you can increase the weight, but you have to increase the weight and the grade, but you got to hold your speed at a safe rate. So in other words, you can't go faster with more weight in the beginning. You can go faster with more weight later on, but typically you've got the concern is that the footing remain safe, and that is something that you all have to. That's an individual evaluation that you have to make based on what you know your ground to be.
And the reverse side of the coin, what rest intervals?
Okay, the rest intervals are kind of the closer you get to the event, the more rest they need. And the reason for that is this, is that you need to give them a chance to repair and compensate. In other words, they need to not just repair, but they need to go a little bit better than repair. They need to repair and rest, and that's how you build that muscle back. And the worst thing that I found in the UAE was that we would get horses really fit, but we kept training them right up until 3 days before the race, and they were tired going into the race. They were fit, but they were too tired. They hadn't recovered enough to be ready for active competition. So when I tell you, I'm not going to tell you number of days because or number of hours or any of that sort of thing, because that depends on how hard you have worked them. Now, there are going to be some people that will never work their horse hard enough, but what, 2 days rest isn't good enough. They just won't. And there will be some featherweight riders that will not ride their horses hard enough, but 2 or 3 days would be enough. And the reason is that you have to drive their heart rate up in order to fatigue them enough to have done enough muscle damage for them to build better muscle.
I want to almost go back to the lactic acid thing on this, because it's like some of us, and this is very personal, have the luxury of hills that
yep.
we can condition on. And
yep.
you can drive your horse's pulse rate up to 200 without too much trouble.
Have you gone to 250?
Yes. Is it sort of like a given that you're building up lactic acid at that stage?
No. You can't say that. You can't say that. If you haven't gone to 250, you probably haven't gotten lactate.
Wow.
And so that is, and when I say 250, I'm pulling this figure off the wall because there are calculations, as you well know, that to take into account your horse's age and what the upper limit of his heart rate is and can be. But what I can tell you is that we found when I was doing the lactate work, and this is not anything that we gathered enough information and retained enough to be able to publish, so it's not, it's just, you know, it's an anecdotal sort of situation, but we found that you really had to drive their heart rates up to 250 before you would start to see and hold it there for, you know, 20 minutes before you would start to see lactate.
Wow.
Now, the reason that we had to do that there was because all we had to train on was flat ground. And if we put them in the sand and gradually fitted them in the deep sand, we had sand where we could canter and trot in deep sand. But if we did that, we had to be really cautious that we didn't overtrain them to the point that we bowed a tendon.
Right.
Now, Dwight, as a person, it's always dangerous to, since I say that, to, oops, this is a horse, not a person, but I could build lactate up, acid up in myself by climbing something really steep, and my heart rate really wasn't going that high.
Yep.
But I was forcing my legs to, you know, in effect, use muscles that, you know, it just couldn't handle in an aerobic range.
Right, right.
Is that, but that's like pure strength training. It's not what I would call endurance.
Well, but you were also, I mean, two things is that, first of all, you were, my guess is that you were talking about a brisk trot and a pretty good incline.
Well, I'm talking about as a person. So I'd be going up a really steep hill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it may barely be more than a walk. It was just so steep that, you know, it was building lactate up quickly.
Right, right. And you can do that, but you have to do that. You have to keep up the way that you get that done is to drive the horse. And I don't know for sure that I would. I'd have to see your lactate levels before I could comment on that. But, and you can do that in the horse if you have a long hill and you can push him up the long hill. The problem is that by the time they get fairly fit, these horses are remarkable at how quickly they can recover. And so it takes, we found that if I was not standing at the water trough and took the blood as soon as the rider bailed off, but if the horse took a drink and then I got the blood, he'd already recovered. Horses are remarkable at recovery. So that's why when I described that to you earlier, you have to have all that stuff ready. And as soon as you bail off the horse, you got to put a needle in him and test his lactate. It's the only way you'll ever get it because they recover too quickly. But because of that, because it is so difficult to drive horses' blood lactates up to a high enough level to be significant, to be readable on that machine, then you have to push them up a long hill or go really fast. And the heart rate is the best assessment of that we have.
How about the feel of the horse? If they sort of feel like their legs are going dead on them,
then you probably do. You probably you do have some lactate. We found that when we tried to test those horses, I couldn't get there quickly enough because
I
wasn't right beside the horse when he started feeling leg weary. And so if they called me and said, "I think this horse is in trouble," by the time I got, if they stopped and I told them, you know, so that we didn't lose a horse and or a rider, I said, "You got to stop right now, and I'll be there as quick as I can." If I was there in even 5 minutes, I couldn't. Enough, they had had enough recovery by that time that the blood lactate level had reduced to where it was not significant.
Wow.
So
I can believe it, too.
Pardon?
I really do believe that. It's you feel it, you give them like a minute sort of to re-metabolize themselves, and they're ready.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what we found as well, that they typically did. Now, the thing is that if you then return them to the same level of work that got their wobbly their legs wobbly to begin with, it'll come back a little quicker the next time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's typical, and that's normal for body physiology.
Dwight, this is Tom Gower speaking.
Hi, Tom.
If I understand what you're saying, and I'm going to draw upon running experience, what part of the message is you have to get the muscle memory, and it becomes efficient at that speed. I mean, we can all jack our horses' heart rates way up, and they learn to tolerate lactate to some degree, but the message that I heard, especially in the earlier conversation, is these elite horses have been trained at that speed, and they get that muscle memory and the efficiency at that speed. And that's really how you start moving up the ladder as far as pushing your equine to the next level. Is that correct?
It is correct. That is correct.
All right.
And so that's why I mentioned in the very beginning that the first thing to do is to establish what your goal is, and if you do that very specifically, then it's conceivable and very probable that you can achieve that. Now, what you may not, if you say if your goal is to win the gold, the individual gold, then you'll never get it done. Your goal needs to be in terms of something that you can actually calculate. So your goal needs to be, I want to do 75 miles at an average of 27 kilometers an hour. When you can do that, then you can win the gold.
And let me build on what Tom said, because it got me thinking. You know, the horse is wonderfully designed to go straight ahead at speed. But Tom just made the point, therefore, you know, if your goal is to do a flat fast race at speed, you want to build up the muscle memory for that. You also, Dwight have made the point, those are fairly lean horses. If your goal is to do well at Tevis or Old Dominion, where the horse has to be able to cope with lots of side hill trail, rocky trail, uneven trail, etc., it's almost some of the things they need to do there are actually going to be counterproductive, because they've got to have a lot of lateral strength and different types of strength, et cetera, and all that actually could
speed
make
is
it
not,
harder
it's
to go fast.
Part of that equation for Tevis.
Yeah.
Your speed comes from the fact that you do everything else right, your power training and your lateral training. You do all of those things right, so that you can outrun the competition, but it's not a matter of physically outrunning them. It's that you do all of those things better than the competition. For those kind of races, for Old Dominion and for Tevis.
Yeah.
And I think that we can never discount the value of luck when you go to the Old Dominion or the Tevis.
But we really are saying there are horses for courses and there's training for courses.
Absolutely, there's training for courses.
And
I do believe that there are horses for courses. Now, I will suggest to you that for the flatter races, the longer-legged horses, the 15-1, 15-2, some 15-3s, very, very few 16-hand horses, will do well on those flat races because they have a longer stride. Problem is, you get up around 16 and over, they have too much leverage, and they wind. Typically, they don't last very long. Doesn't mean they can't. Doesn't mean individual horses can't. It just means that the numbers show that they probably won't last as long as about a 15 one-hand horse. And that seems to be the the horse that the people from the Middle East are looking for right at the moment are the kind of long, lanky 15 one and two hand horses. So, but that's because they're looking for a specific horse. On the other hand, I think that there have been a number of 14 three hand horses that have done remarkably well in the Tevis. So those horses may be just a little bit handier, and they may be, because they don't have quite as much leverage, they probably have less likelihood of a strain injury because of taking a bad step. In that case, the shorter stride is probably of greater benefit, where you're powering up a mountain or down a mountain or along this, you know, a side hill that's not, for which the footing may not be perfect.
No, well, we've gotten on to point number five. Are there horses for courses, and how important is it to select and train a horse towards specific types of competitions?
If you have the ability to select horses for competitions, then absolutely you should.
Yeah.
And absolutely you should train any horse that you're going to train differently for different races. Now, this is another place where I talk, you know, the goal thing comes back. If you're doing this because it's your passion and your pleasure and you like going about every other weekend all summer long, then and you like going to lots of different places and you like seeing different terrain and that sort of thing, then you need to train a middle-of-the-road horse for middle-of-the-road performance, and that will allow you to be able to enjoy your passion. If you're trying to select specific races to go to, then you have to begin retraining your horse for a particular event far enough in advance that the horse has a chance to change his muscle memory from one kind of race to another kind of race. And so those and it's difficult for me to make a comparison with runners, because typically we don't have people that do the Boston Marathon and then go to do the Pikes Peak Marathon, which, you know, the Boston Marathon is run at sea level and on flat paved roads. Pikes Peak is run up a gravel road to the top of a mountain over which you have a lot of like 3,000 foot elevation change. And so,
but what we do know is that the big guys and girls do terrible on indoor tracks. You look at Eamon Coughlin and some of the others, these little 5'3 people. So there is some translation, I think, over.
Oh, absolutely. I believe that there is some translation. But the variability among tracks that a human will choose to run on, now there are some, I'm sure that there are some cross-country runners that have that kind of variability. But marathon, when I'm talking about marathon runners, they don't typically have the kind of variation in tracks that our endurance horses do.
Yeah, right.
And so that, and then it doesn't, and if we're just talking about pleasure riding and you want to do the shore to shore in Michigan 1 week and then you want to go do the Old Dominion the next week, then that's not a big deal if you're not trying to win it. But if you're trying to win it, those are two entirely different kinds of races. And so then it's a different kind of training situation. And so that's why I say you need to identify the races. If you're looking at specific races, and particularly if you're looking at big races or championship races, then identify those well in advance and set your training program up. And it doesn't mean that you can't use one race to train for the next race. Certainly you can, but you just need to recognize what it is that you're trying to accomplish and recognize the speed and the terrain that you're going to have to deal with when you're setting up your training program. And Tom, you've experienced that, I'm sure, in your running.
Yeah,
So anyway, in that regard, it's not much different. Philosophically, it's the same thing. The problem that we deal with is that bipeds are on only two legs that are much better supported with muscle than the quadrupeds. And so the quadrupeds, well, they can go a long time and can go really fast. They're you know, running on those toothpicks, and so they're at a greater risk of injury, but not any greater risk than an overtrained human athlete, because the same thing happens with overtraining in human athletes, is that that's when you run the risk of an injury. When the muscles are fatigued and don't have adequate time to repair, to rest and repair, then that's when we run the risk of injury, because the muscles, which are the only device that delivers the power and the major device that that protects through suspension, through shock absorption, if those muscles can't do that job, either one of those two jobs, then the animal's at risk.
Dwight, let me be intentionally provocative here.
Why not?
In terms of, you know, AERC basically rewards miles,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
So, I mean, part of it's finishes to win, but also there's, you know, 10,000-mile horses yet, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I know one tall vet that you'll know who I'm talking about, because he's about your height, but probably outweighs you by 50 or 100 pounds.
Yep.
He argued that we were actually, you know, creating a different type of stress, but something that was could be quite harmful to horses, simply because, you know, the repetitive injuries, even though they're not at speed, from the miles that we were, you know, rewarding, plus the stress of putting these horses on trailers week after week after week, was causing breakdown. And yeah, there were the lead horses that, you know, could have 10,000 miles, but there were a lot of other people trying to emulate that and equally getting their horses in trouble.
That's not very provocative.
Okay. I mean, it would be the ARC. You know, if I said that to the ARC board, that would help.
Right.
You know, because
right.
If there are a lot of people who want to at least think that ARC is, you know, avoiding all these problems that are associated with people trying to compete for the WEG, and yet one could come back and say, wait a minute, you know, ARC, no, it's a different type of.
And that's the crux of the matter, is that it really is a different type of competition, and that's why I bring up and have brought up to you and to other people the point that to finish is to win is a certain philosophy of competition, and to come across the line first is another philosophy of competition. They're not always mutually exclusive. But at the FEI level, at the WEG level, they probably are. They're probably two different sports. And so I think that there is room for both, but I'm not sure that our political situation is quite ready to endear both of them. You know, we know for sure that AERC, with the finishes to the win, the no drug policy, the mileage policies, all of those things are with a different goal in mind than international competition. I'm rather sure that anybody that competes in the Olympics and is able to finish is feels good about themselves. But I can guarantee you that Michael Phelps doesn't have any interest in finishing anything but gold.
Somehow, so you're right.
Everybody else's goal is to swim as fast as Michael Phelps, and so that is just a different philosophy. And Olympic level competition is what WEG level competition is to the horse. So it requires that we have a little different philosophy. It requires that we learn to and train differently. And it requires that we probably will waste a few horses. Now, that's the part that's provocative right there. And when I say waste, I don't mean that we have to kill them, but we may injure a few horses in order to get to that level. And the reason I tell you this is that if we're not willing to do that, then we're probably not going to ever be on a par with the French, the Australians, the Arabs, and some South Americans, because those people are willing to injure a horse in order to get fast enough to get there. So I only bring that up not to be provocative, although I recognize that it is, and not to sound as though I'm uncaring about horses. I'm just simply saying if we want to play at that level, then we have to realize that there may be, those may be some of the consequences of playing at that level.
Yeah.
Can I ask if there's an alternative, and that is that we are organized enough that we have vets with vast experience that monitor the workouts on a weekly basis, and we catch these things before they become problems. I mean, does that reduce that other undesirable outcome dramatically?
Well, you know, that has to help. That absolutely has to help. And do I think it's possible? Absolutely, I think it's possible. There are toys and devices that we have not seen yet. There are toys and devices that I, for one, am in the process of working on developing to be able to evaluate horses at a price that people can afford. Because, you know, part of the difference is that in this country, our horse competitions are coming out of our pockets. We don't have government subsidy for that kind of stuff, and my guess is we're not going to have in the near future.
Maybe it's the only thing we're not subsidizing.
Well, it may be, but nevertheless. I am working with a group of people on a device that we can put on a horse's foot that we can tell percentage, single-digit percentage changes in that horse's performance on each individual leg from one performance to the next. Unfortunately, it's not going to happen before the wig, but if I am fortunate and we are lucky enough, we might demonstrate it at the wig, either on some endurance horses or some jumping horses or some whatever. But those kinds of things are in the works, and those are the kinds of things that we need simply because we don't have good enough tools in our blood work. The blood work that we do, that everybody around the world currently is doing, does not identify stress well enough or quick enough for us to be able to prevent injury. And so then it comes down to your gut feel and the veterinarian's gut feel. Now, I'm going to brag a little bit here and put myself in the group with what I think are the elite veterinarians. Some of us have had the good fortune of putting our hands on enough good athletes and enough bad athletes and enough good tendons and bad tendons and good joints and bad joints, hoof testers on good feet and bad feet, that, you know, just strictly a numbers game, that we have been able or have the experience to be able to predict when you say this horse doesn't feel right, then we can do some flexion tests and some palpations and this, that, and the other thing. You know, whatever our little bailiwick of tricks is, to be able to help identify where the problem is and then, try to adapt to a therapy that will allow us to get that horse to a competition. And do I think it's possible? Yes, Tom, I do think it's possible. Do I think that... I don't know how many of those people there are and what is their availability. So I just don't know, but yes, I think that is a very good possibility. And where I see the hiccup in the whole thing is that it's because the country is so big, it's really difficult to get everybody together often enough to be able to do this on some sort of regular basis. And so then I think that we have to come up with a protocol that anybody could follow, and then get the results of that, of those examinations, and have a bunch of people look at it. So then we've got some, some just strictly logistical complications that we've got to work through.
I have a question about the terrain at the WEG. Is going to be, I've ridden that Pyramid Challenger several times, and it's mostly grass, slick grass. And what are they going to do with the shoeing to make up for that? I have yet to be at that ride where horses did not slip and fall and become injured at the beginning of every race there.
Well, one of the things I'm going to offer you is a device called the Crown Shoe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's made by a guy up in New Jersey, but it's made in Uruguay. And it is a rubber shoe that he has promised me will not slip on wet grass. Now, I haven't tried it yet, and I have some of them now that I'm going to try. But the problem is that in Colorado we don't have enough wet grass consistently for me to be able to assess that, and I don't have enough endurance horses in southwestern Colorado to be able to assess that. This is a design of shoe that was presented to me while I was in the Middle East. We put it on quite a number of horses in its early design stages, and that particular shoe was really good at absorbing concussion. I took horses that were sore hocks in their hocks, put these shoes on them, and in 3 days changed their stride just because we reduced the concussion on the hocks. Didn't do anything else, just that. We took horses that were sore-footed in the front and put these shoes on them, and in 3 to 5 days, the soreness was gone out of their front feet. So that is...
Is it commercially available?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's it called, Crown?
Crown. And I will talk to this guy in the next couple of days, not today because he's out of town or out of the country, but I think on Thursday he's back. And I will call him and find out where and how it's being distributed, so that it's a little bit tricky to apply. What it is it's made out of a rubber, and there's a measure of the cushion absorbing capability of rubber, and it's measured in something called durometers, I believe. But don't hold me to that. At any rate, he has done a lot of work on and this guy started out developing this shoe for standard bred racehorses that train on cinder tracks, which are very, very hard, very firm. And he was able to develop a shoe that would help, that helped his standard bred horses. And now he's had it on some horses in South America, on flat races. The most famous being a horse called Invasor, or Invasor, that Sheikh Hamdan bought from Uruguay, that turned around and went to Dubai and won the World Cup. And that horse had those shoes on when he left Uruguay. At any rate, long and the short of this story is that may be a shoe that we should test on some of our horses on wet grass to find out if it's going to do what he says that it will do, and he promised me that it would not slip on any surface. So I'm not sure that I like that if we were going to race on asphalt like they do in Europe, because I think that we need a little bit of skid, and I'm worried that if it grips too well on something like asphalt, that we send a different kind of shock up through the leg. But because the skid, as a horse's foot hits the ground when viewed on the high-speed video, most horses that are unshod, most horses that are shod, will, when they hit the ground, if the surface will allow it, they'll skid just a little bit. You know, it's measured in micrometers, not even in millimeters, probably. Maybe millimeters, but certainly not centimeters. And and that is a part of the way that they cushion the impact of the blow is by through the slide. So we have to be a little bit careful about that if we're talking about doing a 100 miles on, like in Europe, where they'll do 80 of the 100 miles will be on asphalt. But I don't think that's going to happen here and at the WEG, and so this shoe may be very useful. But what we have to do is it has been tested up to 35 miles, and it has worn well, but we haven't tested it for 50 or 100 miles yet. So we've got to get that done between now and
on multiple horses.
On what type of terrain also? What type of terrain?
Well, and I don't have that information. It was done, that test was done in Uruguay, and I read the report by the veterinarian who checked the horse every 5 kilometers throughout the 35-mile race and however many kilometers. I guess that's close to 50 kilometers. But at any rate, it withstood that without any trouble, but I did not see the shoes. And I can tell you that the same shoe that we had in Dubai, we were able to get 100-mile. Or no, I don't know if we put it on 100 miles or not. I know we put it on 75-mile races, and we're able to get through that completely.
On multiple different horses?
On multiple different horses.
Okay, because right. Yeah, different horses wear shoes differently.
Yes, exactly. And that's why we need to test this shoe and see how well it'll hold up. This shoe has an aluminum plate inside that...
Uh-huh.
And then the rubber completely surrounds the aluminum so that you have something to drive your nail head into and seat the nail head into so that when you clench it, you've got a good seat. So it doesn't, and there's not enough rubber between, there's a tiny bit of rubber, you know, like maybe a half millimeter between the foot and the aluminum plate, so that there's not effectively any squish or any travel there so that your clenches don't loosen up.
Right.
Do you remember the shoes that Jeff Pauley put on Leanne's horse last year at Biltmore? They were machine shoes. They were steel with that sandwich rubber in between. And I remember Jeff saying that you've got to have some sort of metal in there to keep the nails from basically pulling through. But it's what Dwight, that second shoe Dwight's describing sounds a lot like that. And I remember Jeff saying that was developed over in UAE.
It may have been. I was not aware of that shoe while I was there. Now, the shoe that we did develop that was the predecessor to the crown shoe was called the Stealth shoe. And that was what they originally designed for the standard bred race horses, and then this is the sequel to it, and a better design and a better product. But I just it was a strange thing because the guy who manufactured them had run into some health problems, and I lost touch with him when I came back from the UAE to the USA, and he called me on the phone 2 weeks ago and sent me some shoes, and I've got them on some barrel horses at the moment to see how they'll work for that particular sport. But I think that if they would last long enough for us, then I think they would be useful. And the nice thing about it is that you put these on, you could pour a sole protectant in there for the race that you could take out at the end of the race and leave the shoe on if it lasts longer than a race. And I just don't know because I haven't tried one. I haven't tried them yet. But I can get a hold. I can find out how these are being distributed. And I have been with this guy long enough with this new shoe, the crown shoe, to know what the story is. But it might be the answer to absorbing some concussion and slipping on the wet grass, if in fact it works.
Dwight, one comment in testing that, and Tom's still on the phone, right?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. Yeah, Tom's, you know, specialty is soil. He's a professor at University of Wisconsin. Well, that's bit of a simplification, I guess. But anyway, Tom, what occurred to me is that, you know, when you get down to mineral soil, you're basically running on ground rock, is what I remember learning. So, you know, on the one hand, Lexington, the WIG may have a lot of grass, but it could also have a fair amount of where you're running, you know, on limestone. Is that, what's going to be the abrasive effect or of that? I mean, in other words, testing on grass but not limestone, could we then get some nasty surprises because we find out there's enough of the trail on, at the WIG where we're really, they're running on mineral soil that's limestone and it's much more abrasive or wearing? Is that a risk? Do we need to make sure the test is very specific for the Kentucky conditions?
Yeah, let me answer that two ways. I have written at the Pyramid Challenge there on the at the park twice, and it was except for some rough rock they put over one pond crossing, it was 100% grass. And it's my understanding, you know, driving all around those horse farms, I grew up in Danville. I think, you know, 99% of this course is going to be on grass, and actually the biggest thing were all the groundhog holes that we had to avoid. So I doubt there'll be a lot of exposed mineral soil. You know, it's not going to be a regular trail that horses are on, but I do, coming back to your question, I do know that these shoes that are being described sound a little bit like Steve Rojek's shoes, and those typically do not hold up once you start getting onto a lot of mineral soil. They work really well in sand, and they work really well on grass, but as soon as you start getting that abrasion, and sand is abrasive too, but I guess it's a different kind of abrasive, those kind of rubber shoes, according to Jeff Pauley, they typically don't hold up in a 100-mile race. But, you know, there's new synthetic rubber materials made all the time, and if you can get 60,000 miles out of a pair of tires, it seems like you got to get something that lasts 100 miles on a horseshoe, doesn't it?
I would think that that's true, and whether this one is the one or not, I don't know. I will just I will try to find out if we can get these on, you know, if we could find somebody who is going to finish this to win on a 100-mile course, and they would allow us to put these on, then we might be able to test that. And, of course, I think we'd have to test a fair number of them to find out. But if this stuff doesn't, if it turns out that this does not, if it does wear reasonably and if it does not slip on wet grass, which would be pretty remarkable, but the design of the shoe would suggest that it might not, it might very well be a good shoe for Kentucky, because I'm like you. I lived in Harrodsburg for quite a little while, and I know all of that farm area around the park, and I just can't imagine that it's going to be very much more than grass for most of it.
So you're a Kentucky boy, right?
No, I just spent some time there.
I lived
in Harrodsburg for about 7 years.
Oh. Let me abandon shoes, maybe, if people are willing to abandon shoes, and go on to,
move on.
Your questions.
Yep.
And Tom's questions were, any success in early age pre-screening, either for metabolic, mental, or structural characteristics that show any correlation to success as an endurance horse, or is it simply a numbers game? The more horses you have, the greater chance you have of finding the genetic freak that you're looking for. Part B is, what role does genetics and bloodlines play in the UAE programs? I think even Part A was sort of...
It's a numbers game.
It is a numbers
game. In the UAE. So I can answer that part of it very, very, very simply. In the UAE, it's a numbers game. The problem is that we have not the tools or the techniques yet to be able to assess or to screen for specific outstanding athletes. we do know that they come along, and when they do, I think that, that many of you have had the pleasure of riding one. Certainly Drubin was one. When those individuals do come along, then you're just thrilled to death, and then you have a milepost by which to judge other horses. But in terms of scientific screening methods, we don't know that. Now, in terms of genetics, that's a very good possibility, but we don't have enough data yet to be able to, you know, we don't have enough genetic information other than, you know, breeding champion to champion. Anybody that watched the Preakness, you'll know that Mr. Jackson bought that fantastic mare to be able to breed to Curlin, and his comment on national TV is, we're going to breed to the best of the best and see if we can't make a faster racehorse. And of course,
but is it not true that there were 12 other offspring, full brothers or sisters to Secretariat, none of them did anything?
And that is true.
I mean, I look at the thoroughbred industry, and if they haven't figured it out, it's likely that we're not going to figure it out in the Arabian world either.
No, and I think that you're absolutely right about that, Tom, is that two things. They have a lot more money and tradition, and if they have not been able to increase the speed of the thoroughbred racehorse since 1907, and they haven't, then it seems unusual to me that we would have the money, the time, the smarts, or whatever it may require for us to be able to do that with our endurance horses. So that's why I tell you it's a numbers game, and I'm sorry to tell you that I don't think that that information is available to us.
Uh-huh.
How to screen for the best athletes. So I think what you do is that you go through a lot of horses if that's your goal, to find elite athletes, and I can tell you that that's how they do it in the UAE, both with their thoroughbred horses, of which they have a lot, and with their endurance horses. They have the good fortune of having enough money to be able to go through lots of horses, and that's how they find the elite athletes.
Do they have they established at this stage what have become for them traditional sources for the horses that they look for, or are they sort of always antennae up and looking around the world?
Yeah, that's true. They do have, I mean, both of those statements are true. They do have traditional sources. They've got a few buyers in each country. They have not come to the U.S. For a couple of reasons. Number one is that if you were in Kansas in 1996, you'll remember that Lois McAfee sold her horse, what was his name, that neat little bay horse, and then she cried her eyes out, and Sheikh Mohammed gave her the horse back because we ride and occasionally sell our friends.
Mm-hmm.
Other places in the world sell horses. And so they typically, it's just hard for them to buy our friends and then see us moan over the fact that we sold our friend. Having said that, they just bought two last week, so they are willing, and the market situation is such that the speculation is that they have bought up most of the good horses in most of their markets, and that there's just not, you know, hasn't been quite enough production. So now they're looking at the U.S. market, and they will buy some horses from us, but our horses tend to be a little expensive for them, not too expensive for them to buy. Of course, they can afford to buy them, but the fact of the matter is they can buy, they recognize that it's a numbers game. They can buy 10 horses from South Africa for the price they're going to pay for one here.
Mm-hmm.
So they got 10 chances of finding a good athlete down there as opposed to one chance for the same amount of money here.
Right.
So they are going to buy some. It's probable that the market is not going to be quite as spectacular as what we thought 10 years ago.
Right. And do you think a lot of that market is driven by the fact that 2010 is actually in Lexington?
Yes, some of it is driven by that. Now, I haven't heard, I haven't heard that they are going to look for horses to purchase here and keep here until 2010. They might have done that, except for the rule. The FEI rules are that the rider must compete, qualify on the horse they want to ride.
Right.
And so that then makes it more difficult because it's because of our security situation here, it's embarrassing for them to come here and undergo the kind of security that they have to go through to come to the U.S. Now, they will, and certainly Sheikh Mohammed and his wife and his entourage came here for the Kentucky Derby, and they went through some level of security. And for Sheikh Mo and his immediate family, it was I'm sure, pretty casual. But for others, including his trainer, Saeed Bin Surur, then security gets to be a big deal. And, they feel like that they are as honest as we are and as straightforward as we are and that they're no more terrorists than we are, so they don't understand why they should be screened as terrorists.
Yeah.
So that's the reason I say that I think that they are not likely to keep horses here, to buy horses and keep them here. It's easier and probably less expensive for them just to go ahead and buy the horses, take them to Europe, train them up there, and then bring them back here for the WEG.
Interesting. I hadn't put the dots together that way.
Yeah. That's how I perceive it.
Right. Tom, your next question was, what does a typical supplement regime, vitamins, fat, legend, adequan, you name it, look like for an endurance horse in a UAE stable?
Well, that's pretty simple. Every vitamin that is available, as much fat as the horse will eat, legend probably once a week, adequan once a week.
Wow.
Now,
this is what's called when you don't have to worry about budget.
Right. That's exactly right. And for the horses in the two elite stables, Sheikh Mohammed's and Sheikh Hamdan's, that's typically what it would be. And so, I can't tell you a typical one because it's everything that the horse can take in. And if they think that it has shown some benefit at some time in the past, then they use it. And the in those two stables particularly, there is not a concern over the cost of these things, and so they just do it.
What about that?
There again, that's something else that we are competing against, is that they will do that. Now, is that necessary for a horse to be able to compete with them? Probably not, but something similar probably is. Probably need adequan fairly regularly. Legend probably not quite as often.
When you say fairly regularly, weekly?
Yeah, I'd do it weekly if I could, and if I couldn't afford adequan weekly, I'd probably get a generic. I'd probably get a compounded version. I don't know what the difference is between adequan and a compounded version of the same thing. The active ingredient is the same.
Now, the adequan people say that they would recommend adequan like every 4 days, if I remember their pitch.
Every 4 days for 28, for 7 treatments.
Yeah.
28 days. And then as needed.
Right, and then exactly the as needed.
So there's where the hitch comes, is how often is it needed? Well, it depends on how often, how hard you're working your horse, and does he have any problems? As a maintenance for an otherwise apparently normal horse, you know, once a month may be sufficient. Once every 2 weeks probably is adequate.
Interesting. Okay, and Tom, your final question was, how did they balance between speed, which often equates to increased likelihood of injury, and long, slow mileage?
And can I modify that question or add an addendum to it? There's a lot of talk now about supplementing these long, hard runs with power walks for hours, presumably to avoid the concussion, but to try to, you know, add to the fitness. So if you'd comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
And we did that quite a bit while we were over there. We would walk all summer long in the heat of typically up to about 100 or 105 degrees-ish. And what they would do is they would go for 3 and 4 and 5 hour walks in all summer long, and that was partly to help fit the horses to be able to handle the heat, to be able to handle the humidity, but without much trauma on the joints. And if you walked them in even the least bit of sand, you could certainly get them sweating pretty darn good. Now, my last couple of seasons that I was there over the summer, I took a couple of horses and did some rehab work on some tendon and suspensory injuries, and I would actually take my 220 pounds and ride in the mornings early, and because I wasn't tough enough, but it would be 30 degrees Celsius, which is about 90 or 91 degrees, in the morning before the sun came up, and I'd be out walking and cantering in the desert. So slow cantering and power walking. Power walking would be through sand, and cantering, of course, would be on, 4 or 5 inches of sand would be the deepest that I would go. But there we had sand that was up to their fetlocks, and they trained in that from time to time. So, anyway, how did they balance between speed? They wanted speed, and so they trained at speed, and trained mostly at speed during the racing season. They did the slower training and the long, slow mileage. Basically, they don't do long, slow mileage because the kind of long, slow mileage that we use to build a horse, they buy horses usually that are at that stage. So what they're using is long, slow mileage to not to build the horse's musculoskeletal system, but to fit them metabolically for the conditions over there. So we do that in the summer and up until up through about September, and then in September we'd start cranking up the speed and do quite a little bit of speed work during October, and then begin racing in November and race all the way through April. Give them about a month or 6 weeks off at the end of April for them to start to heal up, and then start them back on a walking program again.
I was curious just how much sort of absolute rest they get during the off season. You're suggesting 6 weeks, 2 months off.
That's 6 weeks. Now, individual horses that have, you know, injury issues that may need more time, of course they get that. This is talking about horses that, you know, have completed the season apparently okay and just look like they're tired, or, you know, not necessarily even tired, but at the end of the season they give them some time. The horses that competed through the season, now they typically train even through April and May if they are taking horses to Europe. But that's you know, usually a different set of horses than the ones that they race all winter in Dubai. They usually take that group of horses and don't intend to take those to Europe. They keep that bunch of horses in the UAE with the intention of using them the next season, and then have new horses, different horses that they're going to take to Europe.
What's the longevity of a racing horse there, of a racing endurance horse?
Three seasons.
Three seasons. And then where do they go? Just out of curiosity.
Well, horses that have the personality that will allow them to will be given to riding programs or to family members as pleasure horses.
Mm-hmm.
And, some horses can do that.
Right.
Other horses just can't do that.
Right.
Horses that can't do that typically go to a retirement village. They call it a retirement village. It's just a farm where horses are turned out in like 5-acre paddocks with maybe 8 or 10 feeders out there, and they just feed them for the rest of their life.
Mm.
They don't do anything else. Some injured horses that have injuries that would prevent them from being able to be comfortable as a riding school horse,
mm-hmm.
then some of those are retired also to that same kind of deal. And in the retirement village, they have they put horses in groups where they're fairly similarly matched in terms of their alpha-ness and beta-ness and gamma-ness, and so that that they match horses together so that they don't get horses that are going to be beat up too badly in with really aggressive horses.
Interesting. I always wondered what they did with those hundreds of horses, thousands of horses.
That's what they do. They feel like it's part of their culture.
Right.
That once they take them, then they own them, and they either give them to someone else whose responsibility it is to take care of. And that typically is what happens if it either goes to a family member or to a riding school. And then, but if it's not satisfactory, then some horses have come back, as being unsatisfactory, and because they don't always know how they're going to turn out after they're let down from the racing program. Then, if they're not satisfactory for the intended use, then they can be returned, and then they go to the retirement farms.
Okay. So what's the typical age of horses retired there then? 10?
Probably typical is 10. There'll be a few horses that will be, and that depends on when they come.
Mm-hmm.
You asked me for averages and typicals.
Yeah.
And because typically 10 to 14 probably is the age at which they would be retired. Because typically they come at 6 or 7 or 8, and then they have 3 seasons that they're actively competitive. And there are a few horses that have competed 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
There are some that never compete the first year. Typically American horses don't have a very good record over there because the ones that they purchased in the past, they purchased horses that had a good record in the USA, and they had quite a few miles on them. And so they were probably already on the downhill side of the bell curve as far as their career. And then they asked them to race rather than ride, endurance ride. So they asked them to go at a faster, harder speed. And over there, they train pretty hard because they compete pretty hard, and not all horses make it through the training program. Some of them just physically can't go that hard.
Well, I think we need to wrap this up.
Okay. Are there any other questions that I can remind for you?
Oh, this is Dinah. I just want to say thanks, Dwight.
Dinah, it's good to hear your voice. You're welcome. I hope
you
see you soon, and please say hi to Steve for me.
I will.
Good. And I hope to see you. Any chance you're coming to Montana next weekend?
No. Heading to Japan and getting lazy. anyhow, thanks.
Well, I look forward to seeing you anyway.
That was phenomenal.
Okay.
It was very thought-provoking.
Good.
Yeah,
well, I hope so, and let's do it again sometime.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dwight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.